The next case for argument this morning is Travelers Property Casualty Company against Good. Mr. Spivacek.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Chuck Spivak on behalf of Appellants Travelers Property Casualty Company of America and Travelers Indemnity Company. Your Honors, in refusing to exercise its jurisdiction over the Travelers' action under the Declaratory Judgment Act, the District Court abused its discretion in this case in two broad respects. First, it found that the Illinois State citation proceeding was a parallel action, a ruling that was wrong as a matter of law. Second, it found that, by definition, the state citation proceeding was adequate for litigating the party's rights and obligations, a ruling that was equally erroneous. Now, Your Honors, we understand that the standard of review in this case is abuse of discretion.
Counsel, I want to make sure I correctly understand what happened in the state proceeding, the citation proceeding. You attempted to remove it, or you did remove it?
Your Honor, there have been two state citation proceedings. There was one commenced in January of 2011 that was the form issued by the clerk of court that said citation to discover assets. We did not attempt to remove that because the Northern District had indicated in the Eclipse case that such citation proceedings are not removable.
You mean one judge of the district court, in an opinion that has absolutely zippo precedential or authoritative value? Okay. So one judge of the district court does that, and as a result, you don't remove.
Your Honor, not just based upon the fact that a single judge issued an order, but that the rationale employed by the judge for issuing the order was entirely correct. A citation proceeding does not make Travelers party to the action. It's an extension of the underlying action in which the judgment is entered.
There were two proceedings?
Then, Your Honor, after it became apparent to the Ross Good plaintiffs that their first citation to discover assets had only identified the primary carrier, a month ago, they issued a second citation to discover assets identifying the excess carrier. In light of our unfortunate history in trying to get the first citation of assets proceeding turned into something in which we were actually a party, to which claims could be made against us, to which we could then respond, to which we could potentially counterclaim, to which we could then do discovery, we figured no sense hitting our thumb with a hammer twice. We'll try to remove this one. So we removed it, and what the clerk of the district court did was send it back saying, you're not a party to a discovery of assets proceeding. It removed Travelers from the removal, struck Travelers' counsel.
The clerk of the court did this?
That's correct, the U.S. District Court.
How about a judge? Ask a judge to do something?
Your Honor, we would be thrilled to get a judge to do something, and when we commence.
Why did you ask the judge to do something in that proceeding?
Your Honor, we commenced a declaratory judgment action.
No, that's...
Are you
I'm
talking about the state
about
court
removal.
Action?
Yeah. I'm asking about removal. Seems to me that if there is diversity of citizenship in this case, and I'll come back to that, if the diversity jurisdiction supports it, you can get into federal court either by a declaratory judgment action or by removal. And if, in fact, the state proceeding is parallel to the federal proceeding, removal should work. Right, so it troubles me that, at least on the plaintiff's position, you can't remove and you can't file a declaratory judgment action because both of those can't be right at once. One of them can be right, and if one of them is right, the other is wrong. But if you haven't done what's needed to perfect your removal, you didn't remove the first one at all, and you didn't even ask a district judge for his view on the second one, I mean, the clerks under the federal rules can't do anything on their own. I mean, they need the support of a judge. Did you ask the judge to review that action by the clerk?
We have not, Your Honor.
Okay. So effectively, you've never asked a district judge for removal. That makes it very hard to say, well, therefore, since I was just asleep at the switch and didn't do the right thing, which is remove the state proceeding, you should bend over backward in the declaratory judgment proceeding.
Your Honor, I believe that your question is unfair to us in terms of the procedural posture in which this case presents itself. And it requires an understanding that in the asset discovery stage in the state court proceedings, there are two steps. The first is simply going to the clerk of court and asking the clerk of court to issue a pre-printed document calling citation to discover assets. This is not an adversary proceeding in which the party to which it is served becomes a party to the action and to which disputed rights are determined. It is simply a discovery process to determine whether there is an asset or an indebtedness owed by the party to whom it is issued that might be available to satisfy this judgment. The second stage of the proceedings is that if such an indebtedness is determined and if there is a dispute as to it, 1402C6 then requires the party seeking to make judgment collection to go to the court, obtain leave to start an action that would then actually name the party holding that debt to be a party to the action, and that action becomes removable. We're being criticized by the tone of the court's question for not taking actions that, frankly, we don't believe would be proper under the rules, and we agree with the determination of the Eclipse Court in that regard.
I have no doubt that a lawyer may count on his position being correct and gamble everything on the outcome. But normally, prudent counsel hedge against the risk that their position is legally erroneous. If you have an absolute entitlement to be in federal court, which it seems to me you do, if the diversity jurisdiction has been settled, and there's only a dispute about which of two ways you get to federal court, it seems to me prudent to try both, and then let the court say which is the right one and dismiss the other. But you seem to have gambled everything on your belief that the declaratory judgment action route is the only right route. And if you're wrong about that, well, anyway. So let me come to the question that's embedded in this, which is, do we have subject matter jurisdiction? Which person is there a dispute exceeding $75,000 in amount?
The dispute is between the judgment creditors, which in this case are the good plaintiffs, who own the judgment and the assignment of the insured's rights on the policy against Travelers.
That's the problem.
Yes.
What you want to do is aggregate the stakes of a class and say the stakes of the class exceed $75,000. Well, the Supreme Court said in Zahn and Snyder against Harris that you can't do that, right? It's just no aggregation. You have to go person by person. So I ask my question, with which person do the stakes exceed $75,000? I'm sure the answer is none.
Your Honor, the
state next leads to the possibility of using the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005 with a defendant class, which is maybe what you've tried to do here. But then one has to ask whether the in-state exception to the Class Action Fairness Act applies. And I can't see any discussion of that in anyone's briefs.
There's probably no discussion within the briefs, Your Honor, because, frankly, it's an issue that I don't think is necessarily relevant to the discussion. What's missing from the court's question is that there is a $15,999,999.94 judgment.
Yes,
that has been entered.
Your opponent is a class. And as I say, the Supreme Court has been very clear that you cannot aggregate the stakes and say we've lost $16 million to the class, so that's the amount in controversy. You have to ask whether $75,000 or more, well, actually exceeding $75,000, has been lost via the any one member of the class. Your brief doesn't cope with Zahn and Snyder, doesn't mention the problem. That's why one is driven to the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005, and why I am asking whether the in-state exception to the Class Action Fairness Act applies here.
And again, Your Honor, I must not be following the court's question because the
probably right.
We are dealing with a liquidated judgment that, if successful, would
not
be collected.
Look, let me try one final time. It is not owed to a person. It is owed to a class. That's what brings this case within the scope of Zahn and Snyder. Do you know those cases? Probably not.
You're probably right.
Because if you did, you would never have made the assumption that a judgment against a class is the same thing as a judgment against a single natural person.
But, Your Honor, the reason that there's no reason, I believe, to understand the application of Zahn and Snyder to this particular circumstance is because this judgment amount is sought to be collected from this appellant. And the amount in controversy is thus definitely in excess of $75,000.
Well, what's the status?
That is the very argument that was rejected by the Supreme Court in Zahn and Snyder. You can say it till you're blue in the face, but it's a losing argument, according to the Supreme Court of the United States.
But, Your Honor,
What's the status of Rogan Shue at this point?
I'm sorry?
What's the status of Rogan Shue? Is it a party of interest anymore?
The status of Rogan Shue is technically still a party in interest. They were named in the action. It is only Rogan Shue's rights that are being proceeded against Travelers.
They're your insured.
They are insured. And, Your Honors, it is not the class that is making the claim on behalf of the various disparate members of the class. It is the class that is asserting Rogan Shue's claims that it is entitled to $16 million worth of benefits under the insurance policy. The reason Your Honor's question throws us for a loop is because it presumes that it is the class that owns the direct action against the insurance policy. And instead, it is the policyholder that owns a $16 million claim against the insurance company, requiring no discussion of aggregation of class claims to one individual or to a variety of individuals, and no discussion of the court analysis that talks about the ability of class claims to be aggregated, when the claim in this case is the claim of the policyholder for $16 million worth of benefits against the class. Your Honor, my time is up, but in the context of answering one of the court's previous questions, could I continue to answer one of the court's previous questions concerning why there was no removal?
I'm actually no longer interested in why. I'm just interested in what. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Oppenheim, maybe we should start there with the jurisdictional question.
Happily, Your Honor, I agree with Your Honor that this is a class action case and therefore governed first by Zahn and then by the Class Action Fairness Act.
Well, if that's what you agree with, how come your brief says the opposite?
Well, our brief was addressing the narrow issue of whether it was appropriate for Travelers to file a duplicative action in the first place.
That's a question of district court discretion.
Yes.
There, antecedent to that, there's a question of subject matter jurisdiction. There's a jurisdictional statement in your adversary's brief, and you then say, oh, yeah, that's fine.
Well, perhaps I didn't identify the problem simply because of some tunnel vision.
Your jurisdictional statement says, Ross Good agrees that the jurisdictional summary in the opening brief of appellants is complete and correct.
And if that is an error, it is unfortunate, but I cannot waive the court's subject defects in the court's subject matter jurisdiction to the extent they exist. And it's the court identified an interesting point with respect to whether the Class Action Fairness Act could apply, and that is that that statute is drafted in terms of an assumption that it's dealing with plaintiff classes. This case involves a defendant class, as the court identified, and that defendant class...
Well, I can imagine a whole lot of arguments here. There's the possibility that was just raised by my colleague, Judge Hamilton, that because the class interest is in an assignment, what's been given to the class is some kind of unitary asset rather than individual rights of class members, and that therefore the aggregation problem of Snyder and Zahn is solved by the assignment of Rogan Shue's rights.
And I don't believe there is an assignment in this case.
The Class Action Fairness Act applies to defense class actions. There's a question whether the in-state exception to the Class Action Fairness Act applies. All of these are things that I think we need to have discussed, because they certainly weren't discussed in the district court and haven't been discussed in the briefs here. So I will give the parties 14 days after argument to file supplemental memos addressing subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I can then continue with the issues that were briefed, I think that what we're dealing with and why I think that the dismissal was not an abuse of discretion, even if there were subject matter jurisdiction in the district court, is that the Wilton-Brillhart Doctrine and then this court's adoption and discussion of it in cases like Envision Healthcare, they seem to lay down a hard and fast rule that it is appropriate for a federal court not to exercise its right to hear a declaratory judgment action when the same issues of state law are pending in state court. And that is undoubtedly true here.
When and how did the adversary proceeding in state court get started?
The adversary proceeding in state court got started when we got a judgment and we issued a summons to Travelers Property, and then later on when we issued a summons to Travelers Indemnity along with
the summons citation. Is simply to discover information, right?
Well, actually, it is part and parcel of state post-judgment statute that allows the entry of broad orders against a person cited. One of the things you can do against a person cited is have an order, any order that could be entered in a garnishment, entered against them. And so how insurance coverage disputes, when in fact they come into post-judgment proceedings, this is the standard procedure in Illinois. There's a citation to discover assets. Discovery is taken by the parties on the coverage issues, and then there is a motion for turnover order, which is a dispositive motion, and if it's granted, then the judge orders the insurance company to, based on its policy indemnity obligations, to satisfy whatever part of the judgment it's on the hook for.
Okay. So when in that process does the clock for removal start for the target of the discovery?
Service of the citation.
To simply discover whether there's a policy?
It's more to discover whether the insurance company is holding assets that rightfully are collectible under the judgment. And the only way that is could possibly be true is if a policy exists that offers coverage. So essentially, the citation is the same as the functional equivalent of a declaratory judgment complaint in the post-judgment collection context. Our rights to the proceeds are not...
Okay, see, I'm a little troubled by this, okay?
Okay.
For example, if one issues a Rule 45 subpoena to a non-party to discover some relevant evidence in a federal action, that doesn't make... Well, let's back up. Let's suppose a state court issues a subpoena to a non-party. That party can't remove the case, or that non-party can't remove the case to federal court, can it?
A state court issued a subpoena.
Issues a subpoena to witnesses, to a third party.
Seeking.
We want your documents.
Well, in that sense, if what is being asked for is simply copies of documents, I don't think that the issue, that there is a cause that
there's no basis for removal.
Right.
They're not a party to the action.
Right.
How is an insurance company that gets a citation to discover whether there are policies, et cetera, how is it situated any differently?
Because of the nature of the statutory scheme under which it interests, the label is somewhat deceiving. One of these post-judgment citations gets issued to an insurance company not by accident, but because the plaintiffs believe that they hold policy proceed assets that ought to be used to satisfy the judgment and intend to make that case. And that is why 1402, the Illinois statute, is drafted so broadly, that it provides three separate sections of things that the court is allowed to do with a person cited in a post-judgment proceeding, one of which is enter any order that can be entered in a garnishment. And that is how these cases proceed. That's how it proceeded in the U.S. compliance case, which counsel was discussing.
So from your perspective, then, if we agree with you in this case, we ought to say that Eclipse was wrongly decided and that upon receipt of a citation, an insurance company has 30 days to remove if other criteria are met.
That's correct. I mean, I would not go so far as saying Eclipse was wrongly decided, because the basis on which the district court granted the remand motion in Eclipse was not that it was untimely. It was because, as Judge Easterbrook has brought up this morning, the amount in controversy wasn't satisfied. And it was also because
But you've never argued
substantial
that.
Continuation of the previous case. So I don't think the remand in Eclipse was wrongly decided.
Is there some clear transition in Illinois procedure between the use of this proceeding to discover whether a policy exists, that is, to discover whether there is an asset, and the use of the proceeding to collect from that policy?
There is not. As every case that has been handed down involving the litigation of insurance coverage under Section 1402 proceedings, and there have been several of them, which we have cited, the clearest of being this Eclipse U.S. compliance case once it got back to state court. In every single case, there is a citation, discovery proceeds, then there is at some point the parties asking the judge to do different things and the judge entering an order. And, in fact, that's the course that we're on.
And I'm sure you're aware, there's the second paragraph of 28 U.S.C. 1446B, which deals with time for removal, says that if a case isn't removable as initially filed in state court, it can be removed within 30 days after something happens that renders it removable. Now, I suppose one could say that until the judgment creditor makes an effort to collect from a policy, it doesn't become removable. As soon as there's that effort to collect from it, as opposed to learn about its existence, there's a 30-day period for removal now kicking in. Anything wrong with that?
I think that normally removal is measured from the point at which, as Your Honor said, the circumstances that would allow for it exist, and I think that the circumstances in terms of post-judgment collection proceedings exist once the person cited is brought into the case and know that they could be on the hook for all or some of the judgment.
Well, suppose what you get is the state equivalent of a Rule 45 subpoena before you get your judgment. Then we don't want the insurers to be able to, or the target of that discovery, to be able to remove the subpoena, do we, simply because it might turn into a claim later?
I think that's right, because pre-judgment, there's no imminent issue between a plaintiff and an insurer. That only occurs post-judgment when you use these proceedings.
Except in a direct action state.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And
these cases get put together strategically, obviously.
ultimately, look, these issues are being litigated in state court. We have a case management order. Discovery is proceeding. And as counsel alluded to, they did make an attempt to remove, and the district court rebuffed that attempt. So I think that at this point, the state court case ought to be allowed to run its course.
Thank you, Mr. Oppenheim.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Spivak, your time has expired, but we consumed much of it, and we also let Mr. Oppenheim go over it, so I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I've had time to reflect on Your Honor's questions, and the answer, I think, is simpler than what I made it out to be and maybe led the court down the wrong path into thinking as to who the actual claimant is here. The claim still exists between Travelers Entities and its policyholder, Rogan Shoes. This is a third-party liability policy, and Rogan Shoes has entered against it a $16 million judgment, which it would like to collect from its insurance policy. The class plaintiffs happen to hold the interest in the ultimate collection, but the dispute still exists between Travelers and its policyholder, Rogan Shoes. And thus, the whole issue of aggregation of the class's rights really is an
dispute. Rogan Shoe assigned its judgment, which means it has no continuing interest. Now, maybe, of course, we in trying to figure out the amount in controversy, if it just assigned a unitary asset, that counts for amount in controversy purposes, but it doesn't depend on whether Rogan Chu has an ongoing interest.
In fact, Your Honor, I think counsel for the class indicated that there has not been a formal assignment, but instead this matter is proceeding in the form of a judgment creditor seeking to collect from a judgment debtor's assets, which in this case happens to be the insurance policy. But it is still the judgment debtor who has a claim against it.
If there's no assignment, then this is just a complete...
I certainly hope that question will be resolved definitively in your supplemental memoranda. Has there been an assignment?
I would have to review the settlement agreement. I don't believe there was one in this case. I may be wrong.
But that does not make it perplexing, Your Honor, because this is no different than the entry of a judgment in any circumstance where the judgment creditor tries to collect it.
What the good class is doing here. And I don't know why Rogan is missing.
The good class is here because it is the judgment creditor that holds the judgment that is attempting to collect.
It's not a judgment creditor if there has been no assignment. It's not a judgment creditor against you. It's a judgment creditor against Rogan Shoes.
Agreed. And it is trying to collect that judgment from an asset of Rogan Shoes that it believes exists to satisfy that judgment, which is the insurance policy, which is why both Rogan and the good plaintiffs were named in the declaratory judgment action. I see my time is up.
Your concern here is that the state proceeding will not get to the issue of coverage, right?
Well, my concern, Your Honor, is that we'll get to the issue of coverage without giving us the right to fully litigate it by actually having an action commenced against us to which we can respond, assert counterclaims, do discovery, and everything else you would normally do in a declaratory judgment.
That's your adequacy argument.
Right? That's correct, Your Honor.
But I thought you were raising the possibility that the proceeding that is now in progress won't necessarily reach the coverage issue.
Is that what you're saying? My concern is if the proceeding is currently pending,
So what? I mean, are you injured if it doesn't reach the coverage issue?
If the underlying action never reaches the coverage, then I'm not injured. My concern is that the underlying action is proceeding as if it will reach the coverage without ever being postured in a case where we could effectively remove it to federal court.
It sounds like you want us to assume, in essence, that the Illinois courts will order you all to pay millions of dollars without paying the slightest attention to the requirements of due process.
Well, what I would like for this court to do is to appreciate that at the time we properly commenced a declaratory judgment action in federal court, all that was going on in state court were preliminary proceedings to discover whether we had assets that were available to satisfy this judgment that the good plaintiffs held against our policyholder.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. And to repeat, both sides have 14 days to file supplemental memoranda addressing the question of subject matter jurisdiction. When the memoranda are received, the case will be taken under advisement.